ETF Prime is hosted by investment advisors of the ETF Store. This program is for informational purposes only and does not constitute investment advice. Investing in ETFs involves risk, including potential loss of principal. Any past performance figures discussed are not necessarily indicative of future results. The ETF Store is not affiliated with ETF.com or any of its affiliates. ETF.com's participation in this program should not be construed as an endorsement or an indication by ETF.com of the value of any ETF Store product or service. Visit ETFstore.com for more information.
Now it's time for ETF Prime, where we discuss everything you need to know about exchange-traded funds and the world of investing. Whether you're an investing expert or just starting out, Nate and Connor will help you get up to date on what's happening on Wall Street and show you how exchange-traded funds can help lower your investment costs, reduce your tax bill, and allow you to take advantage of investment opportunities around the world. And now, the host of ETF Prime, Nate Geraci.
Welcome to ETF Prime. Nate Geraci and Connor Kelly in studio. As always, thank you so much for joining us. We have simply a fantastic show lined up for you today. So 2 weeks ago, Fidelity made the big announcement they would be offering the first free index funds to self-index mutual funds with zero expense ratios, no cost. And we haven't had a chance to really dig into this story since the announcement was made. So that's what we're going to do here today. We'll first be joined by ETF.com's Dave Nottig, who always seems to have an excellent perspective on these types of things. But Dave has a particularly unique perspective on this move by Fidelity, because when the announcement was made, Dave was attending what's called Camp Kotok. And this isn't some summer camp Dave's parents sent him to. This is an invite-only gathering put on by Cumberland Advisors' David Kotok. It includes some 50 economists, asset managers, financial advisors, politicians. I know Barron's covered the event. And the idea is to discuss everything from the financial markets to the world's economy. But Fidelity's move actually ended up being a main topic of conversation. So we're going to hear from Dave on what the overall sentiment was on this move, along with his own thoughts. Connor, to me, just at first blush, the most surprising thing was simply that it was mutual funds, not ETFs, that made it to zero first.
We've been talking about this for a while. Like, everyone knew a move to zero was coming, that it was just a matter of time. The trajectory of fees certainly made that very clear. Look, as we've discussed, low fees are undoubtedly a good thing for investors. But when something is now free, you have to ask yourself, what's the catch? I mean, Fidelity is a for-profit company. So why are they offering some funds for free? And Nate, you're right. I mean, both of us were surprised that an ETF wasn't the first to get to zero. But there is some fine print regarding these two Fidelity mutual funds without fund expenses. You can only access them if you are a customer of Fidelity. Now, on the other hand, if an ETF provider decides to finally go to zero with zero fee ETFs, you can own that ETF anywhere you want. Your brokerage accounts can be at Schwab, TD Ameritrade, E-Trade, or even at Fidelity. You only get to access these two Fidelity funds for free if you have your accounts at Fidelity. And I think that speaks to Fidelity's broader angle here, which I'm sure we're going to get into with Dave.
Now, later in the show, we'll also be joined by CFRA's Todd Rosenbluth. Todd covers ETFs and mutual funds as well as anyone. So we'll also get his thoughts on Fidelity's move. We'll also discuss a few other topics with Todd, including Bitcoin ETFs, which I know Todd has some fairly strong opinions on, as well as Vanguard's commission-free ETF platform. And then speaking of Vanguard, Jerry O'Reilly, principal and portfolio manager at Vanguard, is going to give us an inside look today at managing index funds. So, Connor, get this. Jerry is responsible for managing over $1 trillion, that's trillion with a T, in
big
index
number.
Funds. I mean, think about how he feels when he wakes up in the morning. That's got to be at least a little bit of pressure. But, you know, there's this impression out there that index funds are just on autopilot, right? That there's nothing really to do. It's just someone pushing a button or computers running these things. And the fact is, that couldn't be further from the case. And so Jerry's going to take us behind the scenes. I think this is going to be fascinating.
what's interesting is when you think about Fidelity's move and fees grinding towards zero overall, eventually we're going to kind of run out of stuff to talk about in the fee world. And I think that there's going to be much more focus from investors and certainly advisors on how index funds are actually being managed. What's their tracking error? You know, securities lending, making them money, tax management. These items can actually move the needle on returns more than these minuscule fees themselves, especially when we're talking about some of the largest, you know, plain vanilla ETFs that are out there. And while there aren't any ETFs with, you know, expense ratios that are technically at zero yet, there are several of the larger ones out there that at the end of the day, they're free or actually will even end up paying you to own them because of those activities I mentioned earlier, you know, particularly the securities lending. They will actually more than make up for the very small expense ratios that are charged by some of these ETFs. So this is going to be a really interesting discussion with Jerry. Nate, I got to tell you, you know, he might be one of a handful of people in the world that can say they manage $1 trillion. And if there are any other people who can say that, I'm willing to bet they work with Jerry at Vanguard.
Yeah, certainly no bigger index fund provider than Vanguard. As always, if you have questions or comments, you can visit etfprime.com or you can find us on Twitter at Nate Geraci and at CKelly1980. Let's start the show today with ETF.com's Dave Nuttig.
Time now for our weekly chat with the experts at ETF.com, the world's leading independent authority on ETFs.
People have been saying there are too many mutual funds since the 80s. For all the talk of smart beta, they haven't pulled in huge assets. The active managers are showing up in the ETF space.
So, Dave, a couple of weeks ago, you attended what I think sounds like a fascinating gathering. It's put on by Cumberland Advisors' David Kotok. It's fittingly called Camp Kotok. It's held in Maine every year. It's attended by economists, asset managers, advisors. I mentioned Barron's attended and covered this event. Before we talk about the discussion surrounding Fidelity, can you just set the stage a bit for us? What's this event like?
Sure. It's David Kotok, who founded Cumberland, basically started doing this as a way to get folks that he relied on in his practice as an asset manager out of the daily hubbub and, you know, into an environment where they can have real lengthy conversations. And over the years, he's just collected, as you can imagine, a group of friends and colleagues that really come from all walks of the investment management life. And it just engenders great conversation. We go out in the woods, we have spotty internet connection, spend a lot of time sitting in boats talking to people you might not otherwise talk to, and you can come up with some pretty interesting insights.
All right, so you wrote a great piece at ETF.com where you sort of recap this experience, and you said this move by Fidelity to offer two free index funds really ended up being a focal point of the conversations there. First, were you surprised at all that it wasn't ETFs to reach zero first?
Not so much, right? I mean, one of the things about mutual funds people forget is that they're quite controllable. So, for instance, you guys pointed out in the preamble here that you can only get access to these funds if you have a Fidelity account and you're buying it in that Fidelity account. You can't do that with an ETF, right? So their hidden agenda here, which isn't very hidden, is to get people to open Fidelity accounts, to move money into their Fidelity accounts if they may have accounts elsewhere. And they have lots of ways of making money on that account, whether it's simply the spread difference on cash balances that they pay, whether it's additional services such as financial advisory services, or whether it's simply the other funds any investor would likely use to round out these two individual equity funds that they have actually driven the price down to zero.
All right, so give us your overall take on this move. I mean, how do you think it impacts investors, competition in the fund space? I'd love to hear what the sentiment was among the other campgoers as well.
Well, you know, we all knew this day would eventually come, and I think the question was going to be, does the market perceive it as a gimmick, or do they perceive it as simply a savvy marketing move? And I think in this case, the perception in the room, and my belief too, is that it's a savvy marketing move. If it had been some upstart with some wacky fund on the edge, we would all be thinking it's a gimmick. But this is Fidelity. This is core exposure. Obviously, Fidelity knows how to run these kinds of core index funds. It's worth noting that these are sort of beyond plain vanilla. These are unbranded indexes. They're self-indexed products, which is important because that means they don't have to pay S&P or MSCI or FTSE a handful of basis points to license their index. It's really the only way they could make this work. And frankly, I think it's only in these sort of narrow cases like these sort of total market equity products, you know, where you've got these big, broad, fairly straightforward cap-weighted portfolios. This is where it sort of makes sense. I don't think we're immediately going to see Schwab drop their top 10 ETFs to zero in response, however.
Can you talk a little bit more about what's called a loss leader strategy? This has gotten a lot of run. You know, clearly the thought is Fidelity is offering these, you know, as a loss leader. Can you just describe that strategy in a little more detail?
Yeah, sure. I mean, this is a classic piece of retailing 101, right? Amazon does this too. They take the top five bestsellers and they discount them, you know, 40% off, even though their cost is, you know, 70% of the retail price. And, they, you know, so they're willing to lose money on every one of something that is sold because they have other ways of making money off of a good customer. That's exactly what's going on here. You know, they're not going to be making money on this, these two funds. They simply aren't. Now, they, in other ways, they could offset some of that. So we talk a lot about securities lending sometimes. Depending on how they set up their securities lending program, they could earn back some money on that. I believe they've come out and said that they aren't planning on doing that, that they're going to rebate all of any securities lending revenue to the fund. But, you know, somebody like an iShares or a Schwab could probably get away with using SEC lending revenue to offset fees and still end up in the green, if you will.
Dave, you mentioned this is really a marketing move, and perhaps it's already working. I want to read for you some comments that a listener sent in to us. His name is Christopher Shea. So he emailed us the following. He said, quote, ETFs have now become irrelevant on Fidelity for long-term investors, and I struggle to see how the iShares Fidelity partnership will continue after this undercut. And then he goes on to say, quote, I just can't express how game-changing this is. This is a huge comeback for index mutual funds and a major, major blow for both iShares and ETFs. And let me add, he wasn't just talking about the zero-fee funds. He also mentioned Fidelity's other fee reductions. And he noted the fact that there are no minimum investment requirements for these funds. So he actually said he sold all of his iShares ETFs and put them into Fidelity index funds. I know there's a lot there. Any thoughts on some or all of those comments?
Yeah, I think there's a little bit of hyperbole there. You know, I think it is a game changer in the sense that it is a moment we all knew that would come, and now it has come. But I don't think it fundamentally changes the dynamics of the ETF industry. People use ETFs for lots of reasons other than just low cost. And we should point out, most of the big index providers have mutual fund versions of their ETFs that are the exact same fee, right? So Schwab's, you know, big giant core funds like SCHX, there are exact equivalent mutual funds charging the exact same 3, 4, or 5 basis point fees, and those are sort of stalwarts in their 401k business, right? That's where most of that money flows. Vanguard, exactly the same way. So I think it's a bit of a reach to say somehow this turns off the things people like about ETFs, which are the tax efficiency, which are the intraday trading, which are the transparency, with the ability to do more complex trading strategies. All of those things remain for ETFs.
Dave, as it relates to the overall competitive landscape for fund companies, I know in the piece you wrote last week, you made the point that Fidelity is in a position to run a loss leader strategy because they're what's called vertically integrated, right? They control multiple points of the client relationship. They can make money elsewhere. They just need to get clients in the door. But firms like BlackRock, they don't quite have that luxury. I'm curious, how big of a deal do you think that is moving forward?
I actually think it's quite a big deal. I'm not worried that BlackRock's business is somehow going to be hurt. They're going to be just fine. But I do think it is the case that vertically integrated firms, of which the big three I can think of in the ETF space would be Vanguard, Fidelity, and Schwab, you know, because they have both the asset management component and the brokerage component and all of the related financial services, they're really in a position to extract value from the customer relationship as opposed to individual products. I mean, you can go buy your life insurance at Fidelity, for Pete's sake. So, and we all know what the margins in that business are like. So there are plenty of ways for them to make money, and offering this sort of core beta exposure as a teaser sort of to get in the door, you can sort of think of it as the free toaster of the modern era.
Well, on this topic, I'm not sure if you saw this, but a couple of weeks ago, Josh Brown over at Ritholtz, he wrote a great piece where he said someone like State Street, who maybe isn't quite as vertically integrated, they should be screaming from the top of their lungs that they don't own other pieces of the client relationship. And as it relates specifically to financial advisors, they should be pounding the table saying, hey, look, we're not trying to lure clients in the door with zero fee funds and then cross sell them on financial advice or a robo advisor. We're not competing with you, the financial advisor. Can firms like State Street maybe use that to their advantage?
Yeah, I think there is a bit of an angle here towards the financial advisor market. I mean, Schwab, Vanguard, and Fidelity are also three of the biggest custodians that financial advisors use for their client assets. And they're also competing with financial advisors, right? That is absolutely true. If I go to Schwab as an individual investor with a $3 million account, you can be darn sure I'm getting a phone call from a Schwab financial advisor offering to provide me additional services, making sure that I've got everything that I need. And that is a direct competition to what we might think of as an independent RIA. So, I think there is some room for the true independence here. iShares, BlackRock, folks like that. I mean, State Street, folks like that, to sort of try to make that purity argument. But, you know, that purity argument doesn't carry a ton of weight when you're offering something against free.
Okay, so what's next here? Fidelity has made the leap to zero. Where do we go from here?
Yeah, well, I'm sure we'll see some copycatting. To me, the logical place would be Schwab. Schwab has a whole raft of funds that cap at 8 basis points. It's like their most expensive one. For all of their core basic equity and even fixed income exposures, they're super, super cheap. They'd be the logical one to come back and drop fees to zero on a range of funds. They could do that on the ETF and on the mutual fund. The actual impact for consumers is pretty minimal. I think about $1 million portfolio with 3 basis points of fees is $300 a year. That seems awfully reasonable for $1 million portfolio. So dropping that $300 out of the equation shouldn't move the needle very much for most consumers. I think what'll be interesting is to think about the next evolution outside of fund structures. There are folks like M1 Finance, which are fundamentally brokerages that are sort of trying to replace funds altogether by doing basket trading of hundreds, if not thousands, of stocks and handling fractional shares. That's where I think we can start getting even more product out there that is truly zero fee.
Dave, as always, appreciate the time. Look forward to chatting again next week. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
That was ETF.com's Dave Noddick. Let's take a break, and when we come back, we'll be joined by Vanguard's Jerry O'Reilly. We'll go behind the scenes on managing index funds. You're listening to ETF Prime. Welcome back to ETF Prime, Nate Geraci and Connor Kelly in studio. We are now very pleased to be joined by Jerry O'Reilly, Principal and Portfolio Manager at Vanguard. Jerry is currently responsible for the management of over $1 trillion in index funds. That's trillion with a T. So Jerry oversees the world's largest index mutual fund, the third largest ETF, and then he's responsible for 16 other Vanguard funds. I think this is a fascinating area because there's a perception out there that index funds are on autopilot, that there's nothing really going on behind the scenes. It's just a person pushing a button or computers running these things. And that simply couldn't be further from the case. Jerry is joining us via phone from Malvern, Pennsylvania. Jerry, a pleasure having you on the program today.
Thank you very much. It's great to be on.
So, Jerry, when you wake up in the morning and you're responsible for $1 trillion in investor assets, I have to ask you, what does that feel like?
Well, you know, I would say this, that there are times when there's a little bit of stress involved. So, for example, if we're having some type of a rebalance or something going on, where there's huge dollars that needed to be traded later that day. Those are days when you want to make sure you have your Wheaties in the morning and you're ready to roll when you get into work. But, you know, for a good portion of the year, even though the assets are huge, you know, one of the nice things about indexing is that the turnover tends to be very low. So, you know, the turnover, for example, in that fund that you mentioned, which is Total Stock Market, it's in that 6 to 8% turnover type of year, which means that there's not a ton of trading to be done. Now, I do have to trade, you know, the daily cash flows, but in terms of just churning over the portfolio, it's very manageable, and especially when it's a fund that has 3,600 different securities in it. So it's a broad, diversified slice that I'm trading. But, you know, I certainly take my responsibilities seriously, and, you know, it makes it very rewarding when you're able to put that money to work and track the benchmark and do what investors are expecting us to do.
Well, let's get into a little more detail on exactly what goes on behind the scenes. So you have new investor dollars coming into these index funds.
Yep.
There's money leaving. There are underlying index changes, corporate actions. So give us a flavor here. Walk us through the day a day in the life of an index fund manager.
Yeah. So there's a first thing every morning as we come in, and we have three different sets of eyes that are going to look at each fund. So there's the portfolio manager. So in this case, for example, Total Stock Market, I'm going to sign off in the morning saying the fund is exactly where I think it should be. And if all goes well, I should be sitting on $0 or I shouldn't be overinvested. In all honesty, that never happens. You're either you overspent by a little bit or maybe you're sitting on a little bit of cash. Because you have a good handle of what the cash flows are into the fund, it's impossible to know exactly because you have, you know, people that are investing all the way up till 358. They might be sending in checks that come in that are timestamped before 4, but they might not be processed until after it. So there's a lot of moving parts involved. So I'm going to sign off on that in the morning. There's also, we have a desk supervisor who's going to check to make sure that my work is good and that the fund is where it should be and it makes sense. And then there's someone from our risk area. So once that's good, it means that, okay, we're good to start the day. And then what do you have to do? So there, over the course of the day, there may be multiple corporate actions going on. There are going to be cash flows coming in throughout the day. There will be adds to the index. There will be deletes from the index. And on top of that, you're going to have, you know, just continually institutions who are bringing money into Vanguard. So we have to tabulate all of that together. And then around 3 o'clock is when you start figuring out how big of a trade list do we need to run for today's cash flows. And you're kind of netting all those flows together. And that doesn't mean, though, from, you know, from when the market opens at 9:30 to 3, we do nothing. There are names that are incredibly illiquid, names that just don't trade well. And those names, we're going to try to trade those names throughout the day, going through, you know, different crossing networks, dark pools, anywhere we can find liquidity. So we're going to be opportunistic to see if we can get into those names. The more liquid names, though, tend to be the ones that you're going to be trading at the end of the day. You know, the Ciscos, the Amazons of the world, the Apples of the world, they tend to be the ones that you're running in your trade list for the end of the day. So on any given day, there's just so many moving parts. And, of course, you know, on our desk, we manage about $3 trillion, and we have about 240 different funds. So there's a lot of moving parts. And just we have a great team, an experienced team, probably average tenure on the desk about 13, 14 years, and we have 24 different traders. So making sure that everyone is aware of what you're doing, because a lot of times it's going to impact other people's funds in terms of adds and deletes. So that's kind of a snapshot of what we do over the course of the day.
Jerry, can you talk more about how you handle underlying index changes? So, for example, I think Twitter's a good one. Most people are familiar that was added to the S&P 500 index. So, what's the process?
So the process is, so for example, S&P, they use a committee to determine how they're going to, you know, add names to the benchmark. Back in June, Monsanto was acquired by Bayer, which meant that there were only 499 companies then going to be in the S&P 500. And there was a lot of speculation about what would be the replacement. So Twitter was the name. So back in June then, you know, once S&P announced the ad, they usually give investment managers 2 to 5 days of a heads up ahead of time to say, hey, guys, we're adding this name to replace Monsanto. And then it's up to us then to calculate exactly how many shares we need to purchase in order for our weight to be identical to the index on the day of the ad. And the way we do it on the desk is we have one person that becomes the quarterback for that Twitter trade. Every fund we have that has an S&P 500 benchmark, we are going to calculate how many shares, and we're going to do what we call a multi-block. So we put all those trades together as one block of Twitter to buy. And then that trader is going to come up with a strategy, and that strategy is going to change. It's changed over the years depending on where Twitter is coming from. So, for example, Twitter is in our extended market fund, which is a completion index fund. So we knew that our extended market fund was going to be selling its entire position. So we were able to cross that. We had the opportunity to cross that with our 500 funds. Also, shareholders who are long Twitter, active managers, for example, they know that this event is happening. So it's a super liquid event. So a lot of times when you have an add to the index, active managers who are long that name may decide that this is a great opportunity for me to sell to the indexing demand. So all of those moving parts would have been baked into the strategy, and then we would have set about, having our, on the day of the ad, setting our limits where we thought it was appropriate, working with our risk area to make sure that if we did leave any residual shares that it was an acceptable amount, understanding this kind of trade-off between tracking error versus impact. And then, then you would, on the day, then you would go ahead and execute those trades based on all the information that was available at that time.
Jerry, to your last point regarding market impact from the trading your team conducts, can you talk a little bit more about that? You know, in index funds, obviously everyone knows when changes are made to the underlying index. So
sure.
I guess two questions. One, how do other market participants try to take advantage of that? And then two, how does Vanguard sort of combat those efforts?
Sure. So you're right. I mean, it's public information. It's out there when there's an add to the benchmark, and we understand. If you think about the S&P 500, there's roughly S&P 500 managers own roughly 15.5% of the shares outstanding. So, it doesn't take rocket science to figure out how many shares need to be bought by not just Vanguard but by all S&P 500 managers. And so then you will have some people that are probably trying to take advantage of that, buy in front of the indexers. And, I remember when I've been on the desk for 24 years. I remember back in the beginning when a name was added to the S&P 500, it was not unusual for there to be a 7-8% run from announce date to inclusion date. And over time, investors and hedge funds looked at that and said, hey, if I can buy ahead of the indexers and sell it out to them on the close, there's an opportunity. And over the years, it's actually gotten to a point where sometimes the people who are trying to buy ahead of the index, they actually overwhelm the indexing demand. So as an indexer, the place to buy it was actually on the close because sometimes it actually was at a lower price than it was prior to the announcement. So anytime you are looking at an add to the index, you really have – there's not a formula. You have to be willing to change based on the information. There are certain times when companies that are getting added already have a shelf registration where they are anticipating that they're going to get added to the index, and they may sell directly to the indexers themselves. So that has been known to happen. And so we're very aware of what the volume is, what the price action is. So based on all of that information, we're going to have a strategy that's going to be appropriate for that particular add to the index.
Is your job any more difficult for smaller or mid-cap funds, or even if we look international, where perhaps the underlying markets may not be open, does that make your job more difficult?
There are more challenges. I mean, small-cap stocks have always been more difficult to trade, and even though, the SEC has looked at pilots to try and help, encourage more liquidity, I think that's just the nature of small-caps. They're going to be more difficult to trade than the more liquid names. On the international side, you do run into some issues where, cash flow is coming in today. Those markets are already closed. However, we at Vanguard fair value price our international funds so that if there is activity that happens here in the U.S., our international funds are going to reflect that at the close today. And so when our international side of the desk is trading, they are going to be interacting closely with our desks in London and also in Australia, and passing on the instructions for the fund. And then the traders on the ground there are going to, use their expertise to get us the best execution possible.
Our guest is Jerry O'Reilly, Principal and Portfolio Manager at Vanguard. Jerry oversees some $1 trillion in Vanguard index funds. Jerry, there are several Vanguard funds and ETFs where your efforts effectively result in the fund being free to investors through positive tracking error. I believe the Vanguard S&P 500 ETF VOO has been an example of that. The Vanguard Total Stock Market ETF VTI. Can you explain how that occurs?
Sure. So there's a couple of reasons for that. I would say, number one, our security lending is a very profitable area for the funds in terms of 100% of the net proceeds from security lending goes to the funds themselves. And that can actually add up to some meaningful basis points over the course of a year. So, for example, in total stock market, that has been in the 1 to 2 basis points a year in added value to the fund. I would say the other 2 basis points is probably along the lines of, you know, when we have cash flows coming in on a daily basis, we're spending $2 to $3 billion a day. There potentially is an opportunity to get prices that are better than the closing price. Over when we have rebalances, which is once a quarter, we've been known to trade $50-60 billion over the course of a rebalance. And doing those rebalances, there are also opportunities to pick up nickels and dimes when you're trading that kind of size. So we also have an opportunity when we're participating in syndicate offerings to potentially add some value. So I think a combination of security lending plus the trading plus syndicate kind of can add to, you know, 3-4 basis points worth of performance over the course of a year.
Also, in terms of adding value, I know Vanguard has a patent on ETFs as a share class of mutual funds,
sure,
and that can offer some unique advantages. I think perhaps most notably on the tax efficiency side of the equation.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about that structure,
sure,
and perhaps the importance of managing funds from a tax perspective?
Yeah, absolutely. So you're right. I mean, we're very fortunate in that. If you think, for example, our index funds, if there's an add to the index, you know, oftentimes we can use cash flow that's coming in that day to fund the add to the benchmark. So there's no need for us to sell a slice of the benchmark to fund that. So from a tax efficiency point of view, that's a great plus for us. Also, when we have ETF redeems, you know, I'm sure we have low-cost lots in Apple and Amazon in our funds. When we redeem, when an AP comes in and we have to do a redeem, we can redeem the lower-cost lots in our fund, which benefits all shareholders in the fund. One of the other things that we do is if investors are looking to come into the fund short-term, so say, some for example, someone fires a manager and they're looking, I just want to park the money for 2 to 3 months, we really don't want that money coming into the mutual fund itself because we incur, you know, transaction costs, commission costs, and potentially impact. So we'd rather that if someone is coming into our mutual fund, that they're coming in for at least a year. However, having the ETF as an option is something that's available where you can say to an investor, listen, if you're only looking to come in for 2 months, you can purchase into the ETF, incur your own transaction costs, and that way we're protecting the long-term shareholders in the fund. And I would say, finally, if you have redemptions from the regular fund, we have the option to sell high-cost lots, which is going to realize losses, which benefits kind of all the shareholders of the fund. So having the ETF share class is a great benefit for us.
Jerry, we have just a couple of minutes left here. As investors have gravitated to index funds over the past several years, and actually probably since the financial crisis, has that made your job any more difficult? And I think you began to touch on this a bit earlier, but does the size of index funds ultimately matter? Because I just think on the active side, it can become more difficult as funds get bigger, because theoretically, an active manager has to go chase down new investment opportunities to add value, right? Those may or may not exist.
Yeah.
What about challenges on the passive side?
So on the passive side, I think, you know, if you look in the U.S., for example, passive ownership is about 25% of the shares outstanding. So there's still 75% that it's non-passive. And one of the other things that's kind of unique to passive investing is that turnover in the funds tend to be so low. So you're talking about single-digit turnover. So even though the assets are large, like, so for example, in total stock market, you know, $740 billion in assets in the fund, the turnover is only in that 5 to 6% range. So there's not a ton of turnover going on. And so it's very manageable, especially, you know, when I have 3,600 securities to trade. So on a given day, if I have $500 or $600 million coming in today, I'm probably buying 1,200 names. Yes, I'm buying Apple and Amazon and Microsoft, but I'm buying a slice of the benchmark. And I know that none of those names really, you know, even if I'm spending $2 to $3 billion, if we think about it, there's roughly $400-450 billion is going to trade in the market today. I'm less than 0.5%. So it's very, very manageable for me to trade that. And so I would say, even though indexing is becoming large, it's absolutely not a problem to trade the cash flows that we're getting into the funds right now.
As indexing continues to grow in popularity and we see investors place more emphasis on fund fees and we continue to see the overall cost of index funds come down, do you think roles such as yours are going to garner more attention? I mean, you tell me, but my guess is, what, 5-10 years ago, probably nobody cared about what was going on behind the scenes with things like securities lending. But now It does seem like there's interest there. Is this sort of a new frontier in terms of fund evaluation?
Well, it is. I mean, I think one of the real advantages, if you were to ask me, you know, what makes Vanguard any different, one of the first things I would say is the experience that we have, you know, we have Mike Buick has been on our desk for 30 years and has kind of understands market structure, understands indexing. And certainly, you know, the average tenure, I would say, is probably in that 12 to 13 range, as I mentioned earlier. So just having that level of experience on the desk, yeah, you know, expense ratios are a very important factor, but they're not everything. I would say understanding index methodology, understanding market structure, how you handle large rebalances, all of these are ways that you can add incremental value to the fund, understanding what that trade-off is between impact and tracking error, and having a good, risk group that can oversee this. We also work closely with our transaction cost analysis team to analyze all of our trading. So all of those are different components which can be the difference between a desk that's doing a job well and maybe one that's not doing so well. So there is greater emphasis on it, but I think we're well positioned going forward to do well on that front.
All right, Jerry, before we let you go, on a personal note, I read that you actually represented Ireland in the 1988 Summer Olympics. You ran track. You ran the 1500. And as I understand it, you've broken the four-minute barrier multiple times. So my question is this. What's more difficult, running an index fund or running a sub a four-minute metric mile?
Well, I'll tell you, if I was to try and break a sub four-minute mile today, that wouldn't work out so well. but it, I mean, back then, I mean, you know, there's something I think I read sometime that there's only 1,500 people to ever break sub four-minute miles, so it's a fairly elite club, and I'm delighted that I was able to do it back in the day. You know, the two very different challenges, right? I mean, you go through life, there's certain things that are like, this is something I really want to accomplish. You know, I grew up in Ireland. My goal was to try and get a scholarship to come to the United States. I ended up coming to Villanova, which is very well known for its middle-distance running. And once I got to Villanova, then it was, okay, now the more senior people on the team, the thing was you have to be able to break 4 minutes. That was kind of the challenge. And so that was a goal of mine, and I managed to do it my junior year. I ran a 354 mile. And then, you know, you move on you through your running career, and then you get these new challenges. And then I would say at Vanguard, it's, you know, the challenge of managing this much money is a great, but I would say there's a lot of similarities in terms of the satisfaction you get. Like when we have a huge rebalance and it goes well, that feeling you get is not too unlike the feeling you get when you walk off the track after having a great, you know, competition. So there are similarities, but in a different way.
Well, Jerry, with that, we'll have to leave it there. Really interesting conversation today. We certainly appreciate your time. Thank you.
It was a pleasure. Thank you all.
That was Jerry O'Reilly, Principal and Portfolio Manager at Vanguard. Let's take a break, and when we come back, we'll be joined by CFRA's Todd Rosenbluth. We're going to cover a number of topics, including more on Fidelity's move to zero. You're listening to ETF Prime. Welcome back to ETF Prime. Nate and Connor in studio. We now have Todd Rosenbluth, Director of ETF and Mutual Fund Research at CFRA, on the line with us from New York. CFRA is a leading independent investment research firm. I would say Todd covers the ETF and mutual fund space as well as anyone anywhere. And we're going to dive into a number of different topics today. Todd, great having you back on the program.
Great to be with you guys. Thanks a lot.
Todd, let's just pick up where we left off with Vanguard's Jerry O'Reilly. I know you're very familiar with what Jerry does, and certainly you agree it's important for an ETF to track its index closely, if not perfectly. But I know CFRA's focus is much more on what's inside an index or what an ETF holds. Do you think that message has sort of gotten lost in the shuffle? Just with a focus on fund fees and things like securities lending, has that message been lost a bit?
We definitely think it has. So, you know, even at a firm like Vanguard, which offers, I think, three different large cap ETFs, Vanguard, large cap, VV, VOO, which is the 500 product, and then VONE, which is the Russell 1000 based product. There are three different indices that are behind it, and it's presumably a similar team that's tracking those indices. So there should be no difference in the performance, but there is a difference in the performance because they don't hold the exact same stocks. So fees matter. We would assume that an index manager does a good job of tracking the index through securities lending. That should be a given that's out there. But what's inside the fund is going to drive the performance going forward, and I do think that many investors and advisors are failing to grasp that concept still.
So if we boil that down for people listening to the show, where should things like fund cost and index tracking error rank? Where should those rank when investors are evaluating ETFs?
Yeah, well, we think exposure should be higher up on the list, and not just are you in the large cap space, but, for example, or you're in the dividend space or the technology space, but how are you getting that? What are the underlying holdings? Fees matter. They certainly eat into returns, and the higher the fee, the typically worse investor experience that will have, all things equal. What we're seeing is, as I know you've talked about on your program in various times, a race to the bottom of cutting fees. There's products that track the exact that have the same exact expense ratio, but 200, 300, 400 basis points or more are performance different. So we really think exposure matters. We have research at CFRA on our platform. There's other third-party providers that can help as well.
When you talk about exposure, I know a good example that you have used recently is Facebook stock, right? Facebook was down, 20% a few weeks ago, and there are some pretty big differences among prominent ETFs in terms of their Facebook exposure. Can you perhaps highlight a few of those? Because I do think it really helps drive home your point on understanding what's inside a fund.
Yeah, so I think a part of what's going on with Facebook, obviously, is a fundamental challenges, but Facebook, as I know you've talked about on your program as well, is being moved from the technology sector to the communication services sector within the GICS framework. The technology select sector spider still has a sizable weighting in Facebook. It's one of the three or four largest positions overall, even with the fall that it's had, whereas Vanguard Information Technology ETF, VGT, has begun to make the transition and reduce the exposure that Facebook and other stocks that are moving to the new sector have. And so Facebook is a 3% position at the end of June. That's the latest available that I've seen disclosed by Vanguard. And that notable difference between Facebook exposure plays a role in the performance. So VGT is up 17.3%. Based on as of yesterday, according to our data, and XLK, the technology sector spider, is up only 14.8%, 250 basis points of performance difference between these ETFs, with a 3 basis point expense ratio difference. It's the holdings that are driving it. Facebook is a key player in both these ETFs, but in different weightings.
Our guest is Todd Rosenbluth, Director of ETF and Mutual Fund Research at CFRA. Todd, I want to pivot and ask you about Fidelity's recent move. We spoke with ETF.com's Dave Nodig earlier on this decision by Fidelity to offer two index funds with zero expense ratios. What was your take on this move overall?
I think it's excellent. From an investor standpoint, I think it's wonderful that fees have come down not only for index-based ETFs, but they've also happened from a mutual fund standpoint. And so these are free, but what Fidelity also did, a couple of things that I think are exciting, is they brought the fees down for various other investment styles as well for funds, and have made institutional share class pricing available for retail investors or for advisors to use in an asset allocation strategy. So fees coming down is a good thing for investors. You have to be a Fidelity customer. You have to want to be a Fidelity customer and get the benefits of doing that. And if you want ETFs, I believe Fidelity also the same day expanded the number of commission-free ETFs that they have, including ones from iShares. So there's You know, you have even more choices to have a zero minimum initial investment on Fidelity's platform. That's great, and I think we're going to see other firms compete on fees, but as we wrote about recently, fees remain still too high for many index-based mutual funds, so it's a good thing when they come down.
Well, on that note, I actually saw a piece in Barron's last week that included some CFRA research. Perhaps that's what you're referencing, and to me, this was pretty shocking. So CFRA noted there are currently 112 mutual funds tracking the S&P 500 with an average expense ratio of 0.51%. And Barron's noted the RIDEX S&P 500 C-shares is charging, this is even hard to say, 2.33%. And there were numerous examples cited of S&P 500 funds charging more than 1%. How in the world is that possible in today's day and age?
So a couple of things. One is that some of these funds are available with a advisor commission of a C-share class, a trailing load. So of that 200-something basis points, 100 of that is the C-share class. I don't know that you need to continue to have that. Many advisors are shifting their business models as well, but this is just inertia. Fund companies are not going to cut the fee when the assets are there. In some cases, the assets have come down for this, but there's still some sizable funds that we came across that had several hundred million dollars of money and were charging well above what we're seeing from you know, iShares and Vanguard and State Street and the ETF wrapper from Schwab and Vanguard and Fidelity and the mutual fund wrapper. People are paying way too much money because they don't realize it. They're not working with a third-party firm to assess their portfolio, whether that's an advisor or a research firm, and they're paying too much, and that hurts their future returns. The more that you pay somebody else to manage your portfolio, the less you have with inside your portfolio to reach retirement, and it eats in.
Todd, going back to Fidelity's move, there was a lot of talk about this being a loss leader strategy, and when you talk about some funds that may be on the expensive side, I haven't dug into every fund that Fidelity has, but certainly they have some actively managed strategies that charge more. And so, you know, the thought is perhaps get customers in the door on the zero fee funds with a hope that they'll move to perhaps, you know, more expensive funds, other Fidelity services. You can even look at somebody like Vanguard, who just expanded their commission-free ETF platform, where they're effectively offering every ETF without that $5 or $10 ticket charge. Now, of course, Vanguard's known as a low-cost fund provider overall. I guess my question is, when you look at Fidelity and you look at Vanguard, how much do you think these recent moves are a loss leader strategy?
Yeah, I think the goal is to gather assets and then provide as many services to support those assets to make it sticky. And so there typically is going to be something that helps to entice investors in a competitive environment. The difference between a couple of basis points for a mutual fund or free really doesn't matter that much in the scheme of the way that Fidelity or Vanguard or other firms are running the business. And there's other services that they can make up for it. So, and that's okay. Investors, I don't think, are going into anything with their eyes shut, thinking that a free fund is the only, if that's the only thing they want, then they're going to be able to do that. And they're not going to, I don't believe they're going to be pressured to balance their portfolio towards active management or to trade more. So, but once you're in the door, you're enticed to do other things. And many people still use index-based mutual funds as a core and then active management or stock selection around that. And Fidelity will make money that way too with their variety of services they offer. And that's, again, a great thing for an investor standpoint, as long as they understand what's inside the portfolio, because the zero free just means money is being put into those stocks. It's important to understand what those stocks are.
Todd, I'm not sure if you saw this stat last week. I tweeted this out, speaking of Fidelity and Vanguard. This was in Bloomberg Business Week. So in 2010, Vanguard passed Fidelity as the largest manager of mutual fund assets. Today, Vanguard oversees twice as much money, about $5 trillion to Fidelity's $2.5 trillion. However, Fidelity actually still dwarfs Vanguard in terms of revenue. Bloomberg's Eric Balchunas had a great chart on this. It's like four times larger in terms of revenue. And Fidelity's revenue is more than two times the entire ETF industry's revenue. Do you think Fidelity knows that's not sustainable? And so when you look at this move to zero, you know, perhaps you're trying to head this off at the pass a little bit?
Yeah, I think the shift to index-based investing has a long tail to it. It's been building up, but I think there's still room for it. And Fidelity has been increasingly moving their business to accepting that mantra. So they have index-based sector ETFs that complement their actively managed sector mutual funds. They've got these mutual funds as well as others that they've come in to make that available. I do think that what's exciting about this is a large asset manager that's moving and embracing the index-based world as opposed to a smaller firm that's seeing the writing on the wall. So Fidelity has a great brand with advisors, with investors. I think they're going to be successful in gathering assets, and I'm excited to see once we get numbers about how these funds are doing. You know, from an asset gathering standpoint, it's too early to tell how they're going to do from a performance standpoint 1 or 2 months in.
All right, Todd, we only have about a minute left here. I did want to switch gears. You and I had a little fun on Twitter last week. We were debating Bitcoin ETFs. My sense is, from our interaction, you're not overly enamored with the prospect of Bitcoin ETFs. I think you're not quite sold they should be approved at this point. Why is that?
Well, I mean, the SEC has come out, and so once the SEC approves it, then we'll fully accept that that's the law of the land for where it is. But the SEC has concerns about the risks related to it and investors' awareness of those risks, and I think I haven't seen data that says that that's wrong, and neither has the SEC, which has much more transparency on this than we do. So, yes, there's buying and selling of Bitcoin. Yes, that's happening. It doesn't have to happen through an ETF wrapper for it to function, and we're skeptical that the SEC is going to get comfortable with that with that in the near term.
Well, Todd, with that, we'll have to leave it there. As always, greatly appreciate you joining us. Look forward to chatting again soon.
Thanks a lot, Nate. Pleasure.
That was Todd Rosenblut, Director of ETF and Mutual Fund Research at CFRA. You can find his work at CFRAResearch.com. And I mentioned Twitter. Todd is a great follow on Twitter, @ToddCFRA. He has great content on ETFs, latest ETF news. Definitely highly recommend following him. Podcasts of ETF Prime are available at ETFPrime.com, ETF.com, and also on iTunes. You can follow us on Twitter, @NateGeraci and @CKelly1980. Next week, we're going to cover an important topic, and one that's perhaps a bit outside the box. We're going to discuss what happens as investors age and cognitive abilities begin to decline. So aging can have a real impact on financial decision making, and we're going to look at this from multiple angles. We'll be joined by Bree Williams, head of practice management for the global spider business. This is one of her areas of expertise. I think whether you're someone who's reaching their golden years, or if you have parents or other people you care for who are reaching their golden years, this is a conversation you'll want to hear. Certainly hope you'll join us. Until then, have a great week, everyone.